We're at the Royal Society in London for a meeting on the new science of ageing. And we're going to be talking to a number of the presenters here, including, although we've both come from the Salk Institute to London to do it, including Andy Dillon, who's at the Salk Institute, an HHMI investigator, and the director of the Glenn Centre for Ageing Research at the Salk. So welcome.
Thank you.
Let's just start with a generic thing. I mentioned to you that, you know, suddenly we have all these covers of Time magazine, The Science of Living Longer, US News and World Report, How to Live to 100, somewhat more technically, a 25th March issue of Nature, which has got a whole section on aging. In her introduction, Linda Partridge made the point that we're at a sort of experimental possibility moment in the whole science of aging. There's a new impetus here in that there's sort of mutations offer potential solutions and so on. But is that your sense of it, that suddenly, although people have been working in this field for a long time, that there's a sense of new progress? And why is that?
No, I think that Linda hit it right on the head. I think that we have gained enough insight into the aging process, you know, over the last 20 years, and now we know the molecular identity of some of the major controllers of the aging process. And so now it offers up the opportunity now to, can you actually change that process? You know, can you actually manipulate the genes and the molecules in that process and actually have a positive outcome on aging per se or longevity? And you know, I think in the last 5 years, we've really seen an explosion that, you know, the original genes that were identified now have been linked all the way, you know, going from worms all the way into humans. The process is being linked all the way through. So I think that it's sort of a new renaissance, so to speak, in the aging field, that we're not studying phenomena, we're not studying, you know, casual relationships anymore. We're actually studying causal relationships in the aging process.
So, for people, of course, we have a huge growing baby boomer population as well. Lifespan is extending quite astoundingly. Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of your recent papers and how they apply to the field.
Yeah, one of them, I think, goes in directly with what you said. You know, we're having the biggest growth in the older population we've ever seen. So the baby boomers are now going to be in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And that's where we see the biggest increase of many of the age-related diseases, cancer, diabetes, but also Alzheimer's disease is a major one of them. And so we, several years ago in our lab, we just stepped back and asked, you know, what is the number one risk factor for Alzheimer's disease? And if you went and, you know, queried the general public, people would have, oh, it's got to be the aluminum in their cans, you have the soda pop you're drinking, it's this, it's that, mm-hmm. or it's APOE4, the geneticists would say, which can link to about 4 to 5% of the cases. But if you pull back and you say, well, what's the greatest risk factor? It's aging. You know, and so why can't we start thinking of aging as a therapeutic modality? Why can't we actually treat that as a way to go after drugs? And so we just simply asked, you know, if we change the aging process, do we actually change the profile of a disease like Alzheimer's disease? And so several years ago, we did it first in a worm-based model of Alzheimer's, and we found that if we change the insulin IGF-1 signaling pathway that can make these animals live twice as long, it delayed the onset of the disease. But more importantly, it gave us some molecular insight into actually what was causing the disease, because now we had animals that had the same disease genes as the normal animals, but they weren't succumbing to the disease. And then more recently, that was in a worm-based model, and so it'd be hard to accept that as, you know, a general finding that would be applicable to the human population. Mm-hmm. So we went up the evolutionary ladder, now we just did it in mice as well, and we find the same thing, that if we change the aging profile, we greatly change the profile of this disease, and we actually got molecular insights of how it actually changes it and the way it does it. Is that it takes the causative form of Alzheimer's disease, A-beta protein that causes the disease, and it shoves it into a really condensed plaques. And we always thought that plaques were bad for this disease. But what this study shows is actually plaques are actually a very good thing. It's a sign that the cell was actually trying to do something very beneficial. But if you can make them very condensed and very tightly compacted, then you'll actually be protected. And so this is sort of not only to show that aging is a modality you can go and therapeutically go after, but also gave us some insight into actually how the disease onsets and how we should actually start thinking more about Alzheimer's disease, a very different way than we thought 5 years ago.
Just to expand that a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, especially unpacking some of the initials, the IGF and so on and so forth, because these are all diet metabolism related as well.
Exactly. So
could you sort of put that into a perspective of somebody sitting at home and thinking, what should I eat? What should I do? And so on. Because this is not just this is not just bench stuff that you're working on. I mean, this, you're doing this because I assume that you expect that it to have some practical applications.
Absolutely. And so IGF is one of the signaling pathways that's required for growth and development. And it links into the insulin signaling pathway, which we all know about, that if you perturb actually causes diabetes. And that is definitely true, but the way that we do it in the laboratory and all the discoveries that have been found in all the model organisms and presumably in humans as well, is that you just reduce it just a smidge. You don't go down far enough to actually cause diabetes, but we reduce it just a little bit. And that gives you very, very positive benefits. In worms and flies, it increases lifespan by almost 100%. In mice, it's 30%. And now it's been linked to extreme human longevity. And so if you were to think of a practical way, for example, if you thought you may be predisposed to have Alzheimer's disease, and we showed that reducing this pathway is beneficial, you know, one way that you can actually reduce signaling through this pathway is through exercise. That's one of the things you can do, is one of the benefits that actually tunes down this pathway and causes beneficial effects. We all know that all the studies, there's several studies that have shown that exercise is, you know, exceptionally beneficial for diabetes, you know. But now more and more studies are coming out that exercise is actually beneficial for Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. And it's probably doing it by reducing the IGF-1 signaling pathway.
Okay, now when you talked about changing your aging profile, can we also try and unpack that term? Are you talking about at some point some sort of intervention at a molecular level?
Yeah, so changing your aging profile, I guess that was sort of a little far-fetched, but what it actually does, I mean, it delays it. So we don't stop the aging process, but we actually prolong the healthy span of an animal's life cycle. So in a worm, we expand that, or a mouse, we expand that. So they, in turn, they end up living longer, but they have a much longer health span. And the idea in all those experiments was that we first reduce the pathway very early in life and find that the animals are very long-lived. And they're resistant to Alzheimer's disease. But the question becomes, if you start having Alzheimer's disease, or an animal starts succumbing to Alzheimer's disease, can you actually go in at that point and reduce IGF-1 signaling? And so last year we published a paper that actually showed that we would put animals along the toxic route of Alzheimer's disease. And we found that very late in life, when they were succumbing to it very readily, if we reduce IGF-1 signaling, then they could be very well protected as well. So I think that there is an opportunity here to actually look at this pathway not as a preventative, but also as a therapeutic. So if we're thinking about it in human terms, you know, if someone walks into the clinic and has this disease, possibly changing the IGF-1 signaling pathway at that point could actually be very beneficial.
And how would you do that?
Well, there's lots of ways to go about it. And there are drug programs now to actually go after the IGF-1 receptor and have antagonists of it. But I think that's going to have a lot of downstream effects, because this is a pathway that starts very high up here with the receptor, a lot of signaling going through to eventually hit a core set of transcription factors to regulate gene expression. And so if you hit it up here, there's a lot of ways for it to go wrong. And I think we need to start hitting this pathway down closer to where the action is, these transcription factors. So there's programs out there where people are trying to make drugs to activate these transcription factors that regulate this response.
It in fact, to me and to a layperson, the pathways look enormously complicated. I had a conversation with Gary Rufkin earlier, where he was telling me, no. He said, if you want something really difficult, go and look at quantum physics. But frankly, if you look at these pathways and so on, the number of places where things can go right or go wrong is just astronomical. I mean, so. what are the practical possibilities, do you think, of actually finding this? Because you can't do just one thing.
Right.
There's collateral effects happen and so on. Are we getting closer to that?
Absolutely. I think we're getting a lot closer to that. And I think that's because we're learning more about these pathways and their molecular identity. I think that's the key there, is figuring out, you know, their actual identities and learning more about them so that we know if we start targeting them, what we should expect as off-target effects. The second thing I think is very important too is the timing when you have to hit these pathways. And so that's something that we don't really discuss very much, but there's critical times in the animal's lifespan that we found these pathways have to be engaged to actually regulate the aging process. So I think that the temporal regulation, but also the qualitative regulation, knowing exactly what you're going to go after, is going to be key for finding, for example, drugs that will go and affect this. Because if you look at insulin IGF-1 signaling, for example, we know it affects development, it affects reproduction, and it also affects longevity. And so if you start going after that as a therapeutic for affecting longevity, you're going to affect development and you're going to affect reproduction. And several years ago, we discovered a factor that specifies that pathway to only do the longevity function. So it's called SMK1, that partners with that pathway to drive it to only do the longevity function. So that would be a very good target to only affect the longevity function, but not affect the other two functions. But if we would have gone after this 10 years ago when the IGF-1 pathway first came out, you would have all these collateral effects that we've discussed. You'd affect reproduction, you'd affect development, you'd affect metabolism. Would you actually get a positive benefit out? So those are things that I think we have to seriously consider.
So in fact, this is some of the historical stuff that Cynthia Kenyon mentioned in her opening talk today, which is that, Michael Klass had the first long-lived mutants, but they were calorie restriction by the looks of it. And then Tom Johnson did some work where you didn't have the calorie restriction necessarily. They were long-lived, but they lived well. They had a decent diet, but they seemed to have a problem with, they were less fertile, as you were saying. So that's affecting the reproductive pathways and so on. So I suppose what you're saying is that eventually by trial and error, well, by strategic experimentation and so on, that people have begun to separate out these pathways and know where to go in.
Absolutely. I mean, that's some of the key things that we did early on, is figured out ways to manipulate these pathways just to get the longevity function and not have the negative side effects. So in the laboratory, experimentally, it's possible. Will we be able to do it in a human being? I mean, I think that's a reasonable cause for concern, and caution should be thrown at any therapeutic that's going to go after the aging process, of what other side effects it's going to have. And it may not matter. If we're talking about a therapeutic that you're going to be giving to 50 or 60-year-old people, they're not going to really care about their reproductive profile. Mm-hmm. They're past their reproductive prime. And they're past their developmental prime. So it really may not matter for that group of people that you're going to go after. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to go after a set of kids, for example, that have progeria, that only live 15 to 20 years old, and you start giving them a compound that's going to, of course, increase their lifespan, but it will decrease their fertility and possibly their developmental rates, then you're going to have caution for concern. You need to pull back and really look at this more closely.
Yeah. What's the current state of affairs regarding caloric restriction? I mean, is that... I get conflicting views on this. There's some lovely results out there and so on, but it's not clear to me that it's... works particularly well in humans. We did a panel at the Keystone Symposia, and Mark Tater, in fact, said, "Well, if you're a rodent, fine." But so, what's your take on that area?
Well, calorie restriction is the only intervention that's been shown in almost every animal that's been tested. It is, in my mind, it's the gold standard for longevity research, and it's been the gold standard for 70 years. It's been shown to work in almost every single organism. Rick Weindrick's work that just came out showing the primates have very beneficial results. The fact that humans may not be having beneficial results, you have to pull back and actually say, these are people that aren't doing it in a scientific manner. They're pulling back and they're doing this voluntarily. And so in the human, the protocol may be a little bit different than what we've applied in the laboratory. So I'm still going to hold my my judgment about whether or not it's going to work in humans or not yet. But that said, for 70 years, we've known that this phenomenon, if you reduce calories, can not only increase lifespan, but it reduces risk of cardiovascular defects, diabetes, osteoporosis, and neurodegenerative diseases. So it looks like a very good way to go therapeutically. But the problem is you're not going to get the human population to voluntarily diet restrict themselves. And so knowing that, several years ago, we tried to ask, you know, is dietary restriction, is it a substrate product relationship? And then what I mean by that is that is it just merely taking in the reduction of calories, you get less product built up of whatever causes you to age, and that's actually why it's very beneficial? Or is there actually a program in your body that actually senses the reduced calories and sets up a system that says, we have reduced calories, let's put on our defense mechanisms to try to survive this and actually live through this fasting-like state so that we can actually live to when we're going to have more plentiful times and have more food and actually be able to reproduce. So we asked the question, was there actually genes required for this response? Mm-hmm. And
could it be both of those, by the way?
It could be, absolutely. I think it actually is. I think that there is the energetic demands that are reduced when you have calories, but also there is actually a defined sensing of calories mm-hmm. and a program that's actually set. And the reason that I can say that is that several years ago, we found and reported in Nature the first gene that's absolutely essential and specific for the response to diet restriction. And it's a FOXA, a transcription factor. That if you don't have this, animals, you can reduce their calories as much as you want, but they just can't register it. And they have a normal lifespan instead of an extended lifespan. And if we overexpress the gene, we can trick the animals into thinking they're diet restricted. So they're eating all they want, but they're tricked into thinking that they're diet restricted, and in turn they actually live a long time. So I think there is actually a toggle switch in that's evolutionarily conserved, because this factor goes all the way from worms into humans, that it's the toggle switch that tells us whether or not we're getting a high amount of calories or a low amount of calories, and it gets turned on and sets up this defense mechanism to help us survive these periods
So it would be called an adaptation, in fact, which is allowing you to maintain a homeostatic relationship no matter what the bioenergetic resources that you have access to, whether they're going up or down.
Exactly.
You're
absolutely
amending your physiology and your metabolism accordingly, right?
Absolutely.
So that toggle switch, I mean, is there a way in which you can manipulate that in humans now?
I think so. We know a lot about it in mice and in worms, and it's completely conserved into humans. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding there is that we've figured out the flipper of the switch that's upstream of it that helps turn it on and off. And we reported this 2 years ago in Nature as well. And it's another enzyme pair that helps turn it on and off, an E3 ubiquitin ligase, which is not that important. But what it says is that there's actually an enzymatic activity that we can go in and probe with small molecules and help turn the switch on and off. And the idea would be is that we want to turn it on and keep it on. But this is early days. You know, what are going to be the negative side effects of turning this thing on all the time?
Right.
Is it going to affect fertility? Is it going to affect reproduction? I mean, development?
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 5 years, I can probably tell you that we figured out ways, the molecular identity of ways to toggle the switch in the exact way so that it only affects longevity.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the folks I've talked to, the interviews you've seen on the Science Network, I've asked them whether, in fact, you're talking about a health span, increasing health span. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the science of longevity, do we have, in your view, a use-by date? In other words, is there a limit on human lifespan? Or would something, yeah. would the kind of solutions that Aubrey de Grey advances, for example, of a series of technological fixes lead you to think that perhaps we could live for 1,000 years or?
Yeah, I don't think so. And I don't think that, you know, I think we're getting closer to our limit. You know, I think 120 is probably going to be our limit. And that's already been shown by Jean Gaumont, the oldest living human. So I think that it's going to be hard for us to get past that as a maximum. But I think as a population, you know, I think we're going to start moving further to the right. You know, right now it's in the 70s and 80s. I can foresee in the next 20 years, you know, 90 to 100 being the mean lifespan. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the great thing about what's happened in aging research so far is that we've gotten so much molecular clues of how to actually manipulate it and turn it in ways, you know, bend it that way and bend it this way, that it actually, I think I view aging research in a different way than I did 10 years ago. And I view it this way, is that we've learned so much about the aging process that now we can actually use that to tell us new things about biology. There are all these new aspects of biology that we never heard of or we ever never knew about until we were actually able to bend the aging process. And I think that there's a lot of new insight, a lot of new biology that's coming out of studying the aging process. And so I think that's sort of the direction that I think the field's going to be going, is that we're going to be pulling back away from trying to change the aging process and actually using it as a tool to bend it to learn more about new aspects of biology.
Yeah, it's interesting as I think about it. This is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society, which is in itself kind of an instantiation of the ideas of Francis Bacon, mm-hmm. who in his new novel, The New Atlantis, the science fiction book, described a society of essentially scientists working together cooperatively. But Bacon wrote several lengthy treatises about aging.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. But, of course, that goes nowhere, so without the mechanism. So what you said at the beginning there about, it just occurred to me what you said there at the beginning, he'd be a delighted onlooker, I think, to see those people actually doing some of the things that he was asking for back in 1620.
Well, I mean, when I entered the field, it was still hotly debated whether or not genes controlled aging, whether there was genetic input into aging. And I'm not that old. I haven't been in the field that long. So that tells you that this field is moving at lightning pace. Yeah. You know, we're past arguing about genes, now we're arguing about which genes and which pathways, you know, and learning new things about the aging process.
So how did you actually end up in this particular area? I mean, you worked with Cynthia Kenyon?
Yeah, I was a postdoc with Cynthia.
How did you get to Kenyon's lab in the first place?
What was the route?
What was the trajectory that brought you?
Yeah, the trajectory. Well, I was trained as a geneticist at UC Berkeley with Jasper Rhine, working on cell cycle progression and transcriptional repression. Actually, we worked on the SIR genes, the original SIR2. Jasper's the one that actually identified those. He's sort of the grandfather of the SIR2 field,
which is now associated very much with
aging. Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
And Lenny Gorenti and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting twist of events. And so when I finished graduate school, I had this classical training in genetics, and I wanted to attack a very complex problem. And I was originally going to study schizophrenia because it's thought to be, you know, very complex genetics. And I reasoned that, well, I might as well just study the aging process. It's going to be as complex as schizophrenia. And about that time, Cynthia had discovered a single gene that could increase animals' lifespan. And so I knew then that was where I wanted to be, because that's where, you know, a complex trait could be controlled by a single gene. So I thought that was a very fruitful area to move into.
Yeah, so this is the DAF2.
DAF2,
yeah. Before that, though, even before that, is there anything in your family background or schooling or whatever that made you decide science is the way you want to go and genetics is the part of science you want to get into?
No, I mean, I was not a very good student all the way through my lower education. And I was actually failing out of high school, and the chemistry teacher sort of took me under his wing. And I realized that if I couldn't pass chemistry, then there was really no point in going to school at all, because that was one of the harder classes. And if I can't get through that, then what's the point of doing the easier ones? And so he took me under his wing, and I fell in love with chemistry and, you know, became a student. I wouldn't say a good student, but I became a student, and carried that into college. And actually, I was a physics major, and then I moved into chemistry. And it wasn't until graduate school that I fell in love with genetics, and it was, you know, Jasper really influenced that and really made me see genetics as a very, there's a lot of creativity that goes into genetics, and so I really appreciated that.
Yeah. So Nothing in the family background that would drive you in that direction. Interestingly enough, same experience. I had a chemistry teacher at grammar school who was just a dynamo and would you know, take a test tube, colorless liquid, brown solid, turn purple, gave off fumes, and you thought, oh, that's magic. So,
But yeah, no, it was. He just sat down, and I think he taught me how to be a student. Yeah, you know, how to ask questions. I think that was the important thing, and how to address questions. It wasn't so much. It could have been any subject matter, but it just happened that he was a chemistry teacher, and so I sort of. That's why I think I first became a student.
Well, you're not particularly old, as you said, but I mean, you're running a lab. You're at the Salk. You're an HHMI investigator. So, one question I like to ask people who've gone through this is, in the same manner as Sir Peter Medawar had this book called Advice to a Young Scientist. What do you say to people when they're just coming into your lab, or what's your advice to them?
Don't have any rules. I mean, keep going. My favorite saying is, you know, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. So if you're thinking about it, do it. And don't think of all the ways not to do it. And so that's the way that I've always run my lab. And, you know, I try to identify scientists that are that way to come and join the lab, is have them come through. And I like the people that come up and say, you know what, I did this crazy experiment, and these are the results. You know, I don't particularly view people as being productive if they're trying to figure out ways not to do experiments, of all the ways it's going to fail. You know, if there's a possibility that it may be right, then let's just go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only a little bit of time and a little bit of money, so let's just go for it, because there's something interesting to come out of it, I think.
Salk obviously is a great place to work, and it's in its 50th anniversary year as well. We've just been celebrating it. One of the nice connections there is the connection between the sciences and the humanities. It wasn't just a scientific enterprise. Jonas and Jacob Bronowski also wanted to sort of be involved with the community. As you do your work, as you're thinking about the bench work, and you've got people working on, you know, very precise molecular stuff here, do you also think about the larger societal implications of the work on aging?
Yeah, I mean, that's, well, I mean, first of all, your first sentence, I mean, the Salk is an amazing place. And I mean, I don't think there's any other place like it in the world. You know, it's, people in science, you know, realize this, but I don't think the general public realizes what the Salk really is. You know, it's the equivalent of the Baseball Hall of Fame, you know, but actually having all those players either still alive or still in their prime playing baseball. You know, it's like assembling a baseball team with Babe Ruth, Hank Aaron, you know, all the big major people that developed baseball and actually made it, you know, an exciting sport it is. So that's what Salk Institute is. You know, it's going into work every day is like going to the Hall of Fame, but everyone is still in their prime. An exceptionally supportive place. So I think, you know, the reason that we've been so successful in our own research is because of being at the Salk Institute. I'm pretty sure that if I were at other places, we would not have been as successful. But the second part of your question was?
The societal implications.
Societal implications, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting, you know, aging is one of those fields where the general public knows more about it than you do. You know, they all experience and they're all in tune and thinking about it. And also, if you step back even further, you know, aging permeates every part of society. It dictates our religions. It dictates, you know, a lot of parts of our societies. And so there's huge implications when you say that you are mucking around with the aging process. You know, some people have a violent response to it, that how could you possibly do this? You know, are you trying to, I guess, play God or change the outcome of humanity? And others are like, this is a fantastic, you know, way to go. And people like Paul Glenn, who have looked at this and said, you know what, if we don't change aspects of the aging process, there's not going to be the fiduciary amounts to take care of the older population. You know, it's, if we don't start doing healthy aging now, we're not going to be able to survive. You know, our kids are not going to be able to provide health care for us. So we need to actually change the paradigm of health care. And I think that, you know, in the 60s, Nixon put a war on cancer. We didn't cure cancer, but we actually had a lot of positive impacts on virology and HIV and things like that, because the time people were studying tumor viruses and learning a lot about viruses that cause cancer. And I think the same thing has to happen now. I think we really, at this point in time, we need to actually conduct a war on aging. I think that we have enough molecular details about the aging process now that we need to claim a war on aging and actually make that our focal point, because if we can change that one dynamic, we can change the profile of so many different diseases. And I think that there will be, you know, the general public will really embrace that particular idea.
It has huge effects, obviously. I was talking to Colin Blakemore about this recently, and he was making the point that yes, as the healthy lifespan increases, the insurance companies are now looking at all their statistics and thinking, oh my, we've got the wrong numbers here.
Yep. So the actuarials are panicking.
And you're right about the other thing, of course, which is that a couple of the subjects that we deal with extensively on the Science Network, one of them is the whole aging and diet thing. And the other one is education, the science of educating. Mm-hmm. Of course, everybody goes to school. Everybody gets older. Mm-hmm. So you find that people have some pretty definitive opinions because they think they're experts at these things, which turns out not to be the case. So I think it's very important to get really focused experimental evidence more widely out into a general population, mm-hmm. so that people actually have the basic information to make reasoned decisions on these sorts of areas, which I think is important.
And I think absolutely, and the message needs to come across as well, is that we're not doing this to make a 100-year-old person be 250 years old.
Right.
We're doing it so that a 60-year-old person that's diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease can live to be 80 or 85 years old and get to know their grandkids. Right. I mean, that is our goal. That's our mission. That's why we do what we do. We're not there to self-serve the people that are already healthy and want to live to be 250 years old. We're going after the people that are going to be short-lived for different reasons because of age-onset diseases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole goal here is actually to reduce the amount of human suffering. I think that's the, if you ask any aging researcher, that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Did you ever, I'm curious, did you ever think of doing anything other than being is there another career that you could easily have followed? Had you thought about it?
Yeah, I mean, if we got, you know, far away from, I mean, it's, you know, of course I could have been a physician or something along the other sciences. But, you know, I really enjoy remodeling houses. You know, it's one of the things I like to see. I love architecture,
yeah.
And I love remodeling houses and changing space. You know, I'm really into space and how it's configured and trying to make it better and more adaptive. So I could have easily, you know, found myself in that sort of field.
That's another reason why you probably enjoy being at the Salk Institute,
Exactly.
Which is an amazing architecture.
Yeah, architecture is phenomenal, absolutely.
And has that great feature that you can strip it out and redesign a lab very quickly.
Yeah.
So, we are sitting in a building, as you probably noticed, which is festooned with wonderful portraits mm-hmm. of some of the founders of the Royal Society, some of the founders of science, in fact. Robert Boyle's portrait is down there and so on. I often like to ask people a question that if you could time travel and you could have a dinner party and invite anybody you wanted to it, do you have any sort of scientific heroes you'd like to sort of sit down and say, well, tell me what you thought about this? I mean, anybody that you're particularly keen on?
Yeah, that's a really interesting set of, you know, that's a really interesting set of people that you'd like to go back in time and actually interact with. And, you know, I think some of the, you know, people that really mapped out quantum physics, I would have really liked to gone back and just interact with them and see how their thinking on other aspects of science would have been like. You know, these were exceptionally brilliant people, right, to work out.
Schrödinger,
Einstein, Heisenberg. Yeah. You know, this would have been, you know, an amazing time.
So you actually regret not being at the Solvay conferences then, obviously.
Yeah. No, I think that, you know, if I weren't to do this line of science, you know, biological sciences, I would really try to be, you know, in astrophysics or and quantum physics. I think that's just an amazing, the things that they're doing and the brain power that's there. You're just always blown away when you interact with these types of people. But to go back and actually interact with the people that actually came up with, you know, the paradigm shift, you know, that supported this and worked on it, and that would have been, I think those, I think that's the area that, that I would have liked to have had a dinner party with, was with those people.
Yeah. As I said, 350th anniversary of the Royal Society. One of the questions I've been asking most people is, with reference to that and President Obama's inaugural address, where he said that he would, his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. What do you think in this society the rightful place of science is?
Well, I think it's already been determined. I think that, you know, I think it was last year they polled the American population of professions that they trusted the most, and scientists were number one, right? So it already says that the general public believes in what we're doing and trusts what we're doing. And so how do we fund that? I think that's the bigger question, right? So, you know, philosophically, scientists and science is at the top of everyone's mind and the most respected profession, in, at least in the United States. I don't know about in Europe. I'd assume it's probably the same. But now how do we actually fund it? That's the bigger question. You know, how do we actually make sure that science has the funding to actually go forward with what we're doing? And, you know, there's different strategies that can happen, and different states have done different things. You know, California made the stem cell bill that allowed funding for stem cell specific research. Texas has done now the same thing for cancer research. And, you know, should it be on a state by state basis where you take part of the tax, you know, you put on a new tax and actually make it happen? Brazil has done this very effectively in Sao Paulo. Part of the sales tax of everything there goes actually science in Brazil, well, specifically in Sao Paulo. Mm-hmm. And so do we do the same thing on a state-by-state basis, or does the government come in and actually, you know, really bolster up science? But I would, you know, definitely that has to happen, but I think lower education needs more help than right now. I think that's the bleeding hole right now, is that if we don't have money going into lower education to actually get students into college, then we can forget about actually having a science program for, you know, for more advanced studies. So I think we need to address that question first, and then we can start addressing, you know, getting more money into basic science research. You know, right now it's so, we're moving into such translational research. That's the new, you know, that's the shift in this big science issues that are going on. And we'll be missing out on the best thing that's happened in American science is the creativity that happens with small groups of people working together and coming up with new ideas that I think we're going to start losing that in the next 10 or 15 years if we keep going along this trajectory right now of actually forcing science to be immediately translation or being a big group effort, you know, genome type sciences. I think we're going to miss a lot of really creative early science that could be very informative.
That's a tricky point, obviously. I mean, I talked to, at the Keystone Symposium that we were both at, talked to a couple of people there, younger scientists, one of them in your lab, Celine Riera, mm-hmm. And they were basically saying that they were a little worried, having talked to some of the NIH people who were there as well, that because of the shortage of funding, that they might be a sort of a lost generation of scientists, yeah. The people who go off into other... Yeah. Disciplines, and that's certainly a fear that I've heard fairly widespread. I think your point about education is very important, and the other point that's come up in a lot of these conversations is a kind of disconnect between what the public is led to believe science can deliver, mm-hmm. and what scientists themselves actually can do. Mm-hmm. So that because of some of the media hype that goes on, there's a sense that science delivers certitude, mm-hmm. you know, solutions, mm-hmm. whereas your experience, I'm sure, like anybody else, is that you're more in the doubt business than the belief business, and just walking along step by step, looking for the next stone to stand on to get to the next mm-hmm. Next piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. So how do we get that sense of what science is really like across?
That's a really interesting, you know, question, because it's explaining the process.
Yeah.
And I don't think the general public is going to have the patience to go through that. You know, they want to know, you know, first explaining what the discovery is and its implications is one thing, to get that across, that message across to the general public. That's hard enough. Mm. But telling them about the process that it actually took to get there. You know, we're having a conversation now about the genetics of aging and biasing it towards what's it going to do for humans. But we wouldn't be having this conversation if someone hadn't identified a gene in a worm 25 years ago, or if this had not been confirmed in a fly or a mouse. You know, we wouldn't be having, and so if you had to sit down and actually educate the population of how this actually came about, I think the message that genes actually control aging would be lost. And so I think you have to pick and choose your battles, and I think it's just difficult to do that. I don't think I have a firm answer of how to actually, you know, explain to the general public that it takes time, effort, and money to get to where we, you know, to get a drug. It doesn't just happen overnight. It's an interesting question.
Perhaps if that information was more readily available in schools or little local public forums through scientific cafes and so on, then it might spread more widely. Is one of the hopes I have about that anyway.
No, I think it's Cold Spring Harbor and the Salk do this as well. You know, the DNA learning centers where they bring in groups of people and educate them about science. I think that's a great thing. You know, that's sort of our mission as scientists, is that we need to be able to communicate with the public. And we do that in different ways, but, you know, it's, one of them is when you're sitting on a plane, you know, talk to the person next to you. Tell them what you've actually done, and figure out ways to explain it in lay terms so that they can understand it.
Yeah. But isn't your experience that you usually end up with a spellbound audience if you actually start that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, you have to tell them the final result, then tell them how you actually got to that point. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, one other question I tend to ask people, what are you optimistic about?
I'm exceptionally optimistic about age-related diseases. I think that there's going to be, I think there's going to be a huge change in how we're looking at neurodegeneration, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this, but for Alzheimer's disease, the original hypothesis that A beta gets processed and then eventually forms these plaques that are going to cause the disease. Going along that hypothesis, the seventh clinical trial going after drugs to affect that process has failed, saying that hypothesis is actually wrong. And what was exciting about the work that we did is that we found protection against this A beta peptide that causes plaques. But it doesn't affect any of the processing. It affects how the cell actually sees that particular protein. And so it provides a new shot on goal to try and go after this disease. And I think that there's going to be multiple new shots on goal to go after diseases like this, using the aging pathways as our kickers for the shots. So I'm really optimistic about that. I think that's going to be a really new avenue of a benefit for the human population. In a more basic scientific sense, I'm very excited about the mechanisms of diet restriction. You know, I think that it's 70 years, and now we have the first gene that regulates this response. And so we're opening up a whole new can of worms to look at regulation and response and how this is actually being perceived. I think that's a huge issue. Is diet restriction purely what we eat, or is it actually what we perceive we eat? I think I'm really optimistic about that. And I'm optimistic about the young group of scientists that are coming through the field. I think there are some spectacular, phenomenal younger scientists that are coming through that are just going to make us completely change paradigms and really make us rethink this whole business. So I'm really excited about and optimistic about that group.
All right. Well, we look forward to meeting some of them.
Yeah, they're going to be stellar.
Andy Dillon, thanks very much.
Thank you.